With Nippur, the Jewish calendar still continues to count the years from an enigmatic beginning in 3760 BC, so that in 1983, the Jewish year was 5743. It has been assumed that this is a count from the beginning of the world, but the actual statement by Jewish sages was that this is the number of years that had passed since counting of years began. We suggest that it means since the introduction of the calendar in Nippur. In the ancestral family of Abraham, we thus find a priestly family of royal blood, a family headed by a Nippurian high priest, who was the only one allowed into the temple's innermost chamber, there to receive the deity's word and convey it to king and people. In this regard, the name of Abraham's father, Terah, is of great interest. Seeking clues only in the Semitic environment, biblical scholars regard the name, as those of Haran and Nahor, as mere toponyms, names that personify places, holding that there were cities by such names in central and northern Mesopotamia. Assyriologists searching the Akkadian terminology, being the first Semitic language, could only find that Tiru meant an artifact or vessel for magical purposes. But if we turn to the Sumerian language, we find that the cuneiform sign for Tiru stemmed directly from that of an object called in Sumerian Dug Namtar, literally a fate speaker, a pronouncer of oracles. Terah, then, was an oracle priest, one assigned to approaching the stone that whispers, to hear the deity's words and communicate them, with or without an interpretation, to the lay hierarchy. It was a function assumed in later times by the Israelite high priest, who alone was allowed to enter the Holy of Holies, approach the Devir, speaker, and hear the voice of the Lord speak unto him from off the overlay, which is upon the Ark of the Covenant, from between the two cherubim. During the Israelite Exodus at Mount Sinai, the Lord proclaimed that his covenant with the descendants of Abraham meant that ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests. It was a statement that reflected the status of Abraham's own descent, a royal priesthood. Far-fetched as these conclusions may sound, they are in full accord with the Sumerian practices whereby kings appointed their daughters and sons, and often themselves, to high priestly positions, resulting in the commingling of the royal and priestly lineages. Votive inscriptions found at Nippur, as those by the archaeological expeditions of the University of Pennsylvania, confirm that the kings of Ur cherished the title Pious Shepherd of Nippur, and performed their priestly functions, and the governor of Nippur, Pate Sini Ibru, was also the foremost Ur Enlil, and Lil's foremost servant. Some of the names borne by these royal priestly VIPs resemble Abraham's Sumerian name, Abram, also beginning with the component Ab, father or progenitor. Such, for example, was the name Abamu, of a governor of Nippur during Shulgi's reign. That a family of people so closely associated with Nippur that they were called Nippurians, i.e. Hebrews, were nevertheless holding high positions in Ur, is a suggestion that is in complete accord with the actual circumstances prevailing in Sumer at the time indicated by us. For it was then, at the time of the Ur the Third Dynasty, that for the first time in divine affairs and Sumerian history, Nannar and the king of Ur were granted trusteeship over Nippur, combining the religious and secular functions. It thus could have well been that when Ur-Nammu assumed the throne in Ur, Terah moved with his family from Nippur to Ur, perhaps to serve as a liaison between the temple in Nippur and the royal palace in Ur. Their stay in Ur lasted throughout Ur-Nammu's reign. It was in the year of his death, as we have shown, that the family left Ur for Haran. What the family did at Haran is nowhere stated, but considering the royal lineage and priestly standing, it must have belonged to the hierarchy of Haran. The ease with which Abraham dealt, later on, with various kings, suggests that he was involved in Haran's foreign affairs. His special friendship with the Hittite residents of Canaan, who were known for their military experience, may shed a light on the question of where Abraham himself had acquired the military proficiency which he employed so successfully during the War of the Kings. Ancient traditions also depict Abraham as greatly versed in astronomy, a knowledge then valuable for long journeys guided by the stars. According to Josephus, Berossus referred to Abraham, without naming him, when he wrote of the rise among the Chaldeans of a certain righteous and great man who was well seen in astronomy. If Berossus, the Babylonian historian, had indeed referred to Abraham, the significance of the inclusion of the Hebrew patriarch in Babylonian chronicles far exceeds the mere notation of his knowledge of astronomy. All during the ignominious years of Shulgi's reign, the family of Terah stayed at Haran. Then on Shulgi's demise, the divine order came to proceed to Canaan. Terah was already quite old, and Nahor, his son, was to stay on with him in Haran. The one chosen for the mission was Abraham, himself a mature man of 75. The year was 2048 B.C. It marked the beginning of 24 fateful years, 18 years encompassing the war-filled reigns of the two immediate successors of Shulgi, Amar-Sin and Shu-Sin, and 6 years of Ibi-Sin, the last sovereign king of Ur. It is undoubtedly more than mere coincidence that Shulgi's death was the signal not only for a move by Abraham, but also for a realignment among the Near Eastern gods. It was exactly when Abraham, accompanied, as we learn later, by an elite military corps, left Haran, the gateway to the Hittite lands, that the exiled and wandering Marduk appeared in Hatti land. Moreover, the remarkable coincidence is that Marduk stayed there through the same 24 fateful years, the years that culminated with the great disaster. The evidence for Marduk's movements is a tablet, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 99, found in the library of Ashurbanipal, in which an aging Marduk tells of his erstwhile wanderings and eventual return to Babylon. O great gods, learn my secrets. As I girdle my belt, my memories remember. I am the divine Marduk, a great god. I was cast off for my sins to the mountains I have gone. In many lands I have been a wanderer. From where the sun rises to where it sets, I went. To the heights of Hatti land, I went. In Hatti land, I asked an oracle about my throne and my lordship. In its midst, I asked, until when? 24 years in its midst, I nested. The appearance of Marduk in Asia Minor, implying an unexpected alliance with Adad, was thus the other side of the coin of Abraham's rush to Canaan. We learn from the balance of the text that Marduk sent from his new place of exile emissaries and supplies via Haran to his followers in Babylon, and trading agents into Mari, thereby making inroads into both gateways, the one beholden to Nanar-Sin, and the other to Inanna, Ishtar. As on a signal with the death of Shulgi, the whole ancient world came astir. The house of Nanar had been discredited, and the house of Marduk saw its final prevailing hour approaching. While Marduk himself was still excluded from Mesopotamia, his firstborn son, Nabu, was making converts to his father's cause. His base of operations was his own cult center, Borsippa, but his efforts encompassed all the lands, including Greater Canaan. It was against this background of fast developments that Abraham was ordered to go to Canaan. Though silent concerning Abraham's mission, the Old Testament is clear regarding his destination. Moving expeditiously to Canaan, Abraham and his wife, his nephew Lot, and their entourage continued swiftly southward. There was a stopover at Shechem, where the Lord spoke to Abraham, Then he moved from there to the mount, and encamped east of Bethel, and he built there an altar to Yahweh, and called the name of Yahweh. Bethel, whose name meant God's house, a site to which Abraham kept coming back, was in the vicinity of Jerusalem, and its hallowed mount, Mount Moriah, Mount of Directing, upon whose sacred rock the Ark of the Covenant was placed when Solomon built the Temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem. From there, Abram journeyed farther, still going toward the Negev. The Negev, a dry region where Canaan and the Sinai Peninsula merge, was clearly Abraham's destination. Several divine pronouncements designated the Brook of Egypt, nowadays called Wadi El Arish, as the southern boundary of Abraham's domain, and the oasis of Kadesh Barnea as his southernmost outpost. What was Abraham to do in the Negev, whose very name, the dryness, bespoke its aridity? What was there that required the patriarch's hurried long journey from Haran, and impelled his presence among the miles upon miles of barren land? The significance of Mount Moriah, Abraham's first focus of interest, was that in those days it served, together with its sister mounts, Mount Zophim, Mount of Observers, and Mount Zion, Mount of Signal, as the site of mission control center of the Anunnaki. The significance of the Negev, its only significance, was that it was the gateway to the spaceport in the Sinai. Subsequent narrative informs us that Abraham had military allies in the region, and that his entourage included an elite corps of several hundred fighting men. The biblical term for them, Nar, has been variously translated as retainer, or simply young man. But studies have shown that in Hurrian, the word denoted riders, or cavalrymen. In fact, recent studies of Mesopotamian texts dealing with military movements list among the men of the chariots and the cavalry, Lunar, Narmen, who served as fast riders. We find an identical term in the Bible, 1 Samuel chapter 30, verse 17. After King David attacked an Amalekite camp, the only ones to escape were 400 Ishnar, literally Narmen, or Lunar, who were riding the camels. In describing Abraham's fighting men as Narmen, the Old Testament thus informs us that he had with him a corps of cavalrymen, in all probability camel riders rather than horsemen. He may have picked up the idea of such a fast-riding fighting force from the Hittites, on whose boundary Haran was located. But for the arid areas of the Negev and the Sinai, camels rather than horses were better suited. The emerging image of Abraham not as a sheep-herding nomad, but as an innovative military commander of royal descent, may not fit the customary image of this Hebrew patriarch. But it is in accord with ancient recollections of Abraham. Thus, quoting earlier sources concerning Abraham, Josephus wrote of him, "Abraham reigned at Damascus, where he was a foreigner, having come with an army out of the land above Babylon, from which, after a long time, the Lord got him up and removed from that country together with his men, and he went to the land then called the land of Canaan, but now the land of Judea." The mission of Abraham was a military one, to protect the space facilities of the Anunnaki, the mission control center, and the spaceport. After a short stay in the Negev, Abraham traversed the Sinai Peninsula and came to Egypt. Evidently no ordinary nomads, Abraham and Sarah were at once taken to the royal palace. By our reckoning, the time was circa 2047 BC. When the pharaohs then ruling in lower, northern Egypt, who were not followers of Amun, the hiding god, Ra, Marduk, were facing a strong challenge from the princes of Thebes in the south, where Amun was deemed supreme. We can only guess what matters of state, alliances, joint defenses, divine commands, were discussed between the beleaguered pharaoh and the Ibri, the Nippurian general. The Bible is silent on this as well as on the length of stay. When the time came for Abraham to return to the Negev, he was accompanied by a large retinue of the Pharaoh's men. And Abraham went from Egypt, he and his wife and Lot with him, up onto the Negev. He was heavy with flocks of sheep and cattle for food and clothing, as well as with asses and camels for his fast riders. Again he went to Bethel to call the name of Yahweh, seeking instructions. A separation from Lot followed, the nephew choosing to reside with his own flocks in the plain of Jordan, which was watered as the garden of the Lord, before Yahweh destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Abraham went on to the hill country, settling on the highest peak near Hebron, from where he could see in all directions. And the Lord said unto him, Go, cross the country in the length and breadth of it, for unto thee shall I give it. It was soon thereafter, in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, that the military expedition of the Eastern Alliance had taken place. 12 years they, the Canaanite kings, served Kedorlaomer. In the 13th year they rebelled, and in the 14th year there came Kedorlaomer, and the kings that were with him. Scholars have long searched the archaeological records for the events described in the Bible. Their efforts have been unsuccessful because they searched for Abraham in the wrong era. But if we are right in our chronology, a simple solution to the Amraphel problem becomes possible. It is a new solution, yet one that rests on scholarly suggestions made and ignored almost a century ago. Back in 1875, comparing the traditional reading of the name with its spelling in early biblical translations, F. Lenormant had suggested that the correct reading should be Amraphel, as written out phonetically in the Septuagint. 2 years later, D.H. Hay, writing in the Zeitschrift für Ägyptische Sprache und Alte Umschkunde, also adopted the reading Amraphel, and stating that the second element of the king's name is a name of the moon god, Sin, declared, I have long been convinced of the identity of Amraphel as one of the kings of Ur. In 1916, Franz M. Boal suggested again, without success, that the name be read, as in the Septuagint, Amraphel, explaining that it meant seen by the sun, a royal name in line with other royal names in the Near East, such as the Egyptian Thothmes, seen by Thoth. For some reason, Boal and others have neglected to mention the no less significant fact that the Septuagint spelled out the name of Kedorlaomer, Kadalagomar, almost identical to the Kudur Lagomar of the Spartoli tablets. Pal, meaning sun, was indeed a common suffix in Mesopotamian royal names, standing for the deity considered the favorite divine son, since in Ur the god deemed to have been the favored son was Ninhar-Sin. We suggest that Amar-Sin and Amraphel were, in Ur, one and the same name. Our identification of Amraphel, of Genesis chapter 14, as Amar-Sin, third king of Ur's third dynasty, meshes perfectly the biblical and Sumerian chronologies. The biblical tale of the War of the Kings places the event soon after Abraham's return to the Negev from Egypt, but before the 10th anniversary of his arrival in Canaan, i.e., between 2042 and 2039 B.C. The reign of Amar-Sin, Amraphel, lasted from 2047 to 2039 B.C. Accordingly, the war had taken place in the latter part of his reign. The year formulas for Amar-Sin's reign pinpoint his seventh year, 2041 B.C., as the year of the major military expedition to the western provinces. The biblical data asserts that this took place in the 14th year, after the Elamites under Kedorlaomer had subjugated the Canaanite kings, and the year 2041 was indeed 14 years after Shulgi, having received Ninhar's oracles, had launched in 2055 B.C. the military expedition led by Elamites into Canaan. Our synchronization of biblical and Sumerian events and dates unfolds the following sequence and upholds every time factor reported in the Bible. 2123 B.C., Abraham born in Nippur to his father Terah, 2113 BC. Ur-Nammu enthroned in Ur, given guardianship of Nippur. Terah and his family moved to Ur. 2095 BC. Shulgi ascends throne after death of Ur-Nammu. Terah and his family leave Ur for Haran. 2055 BC. Shulgi receives Nannar's oracles, sends Elamite troops to Canaan. 2048 BC. Shulgi's death ordered by Anu and Enlil. Abraham, 75 years old, ordered to leave Haran for Canaan. 2047 BC. Amar-Sin, Amarpal, ascends the throne of Ur. Abraham leaves the Negev for Egypt. 2042 BC. Canaanite kings switch allegiance to other gods. Abraham returns from Egypt with elite corps. 2041 BC. Amar-Sin launches the War of the Kings. Who were the other gods that were winning the allegiance of Canaanite cities? They were Marduk, scheming from nearby exile, and his son Nabu, who was roaming eastern Canaan, gaining supremacy and adherence. As biblical place names indicate, the whole land of Moab had come under Nabu's influence. The land was also known as the land of Nabu, and many sites there were named in his honor. The highest peak retained its name, Mount Nebo, through the millennia that followed. This is the historical frame into which the Old Testament has fitted the invasion from the east. But even seen from the biblical viewpoint, which compressed the Mesopotamian tales of the gods into a monotheistic mold, it was an unusual war. The ostensible purpose, the suppression of a rebellion, turns out to have been a secondary aspect of the war. The real target, a crossroads oasis in a wilderness, was never reached. Taking the southern route from Mesopotamia to Canaan, the invaders proceeded southward in Transjordan, along the King's Highway, attacking in succession key outposts guarding crossing points on the Jordan River. Ashtarot, Karnaim in the north, Ham in the center, and Shava Kiryataim in the south. According to the biblical tale, a place called El Paran was the real target of the invaders, but it was never reached by them. Coming down Transjordan and circling the Dead Sea, the invaders passed by Mount Seir and advanced toward El Paran, which is upon the wilderness. But they were forced to swing back by Ein Mishpat, which is Kadesh. El Paran, God's gloried place, was never reached. Somehow the invaders were beaten back at Ein Mishpat, also known as Kadesh or Kadesh Barnea. It was only then, as they turned back toward Canaan, that thereupon the king of Sodom and the king of Gomorrah and the king of Admah and the king of Zebaim and the king of Bela, which is Zoar, marched forth and engaged them in battle in the Vale of Siddim. The battle with these Canaanite kings was thus a late phase of the war, and not its first purpose. Almost a century ago, in a thorough study titled Kadesh Barnea, H. C. Trumbull had concluded that the true target of the invaders was El Paran, which he correctly identified as the fortified oasis of Nakhl in Sinai's central plain. But neither he nor others could explain why a great alliance would launch an army to a destination 1,000 miles away and fight gods and men to reach an isolated oasis in a great desolate plain. But why had they gone there? And who was it that blocked their way at Kadesh Barnea, forcing the invaders to turn back? There have been no answers, and no answers can make sense except the ones offered by us. The only significance of the destination was its spaceport, and the one who blocked the advance at Kadesh Barnea was Abraham. From earlier times, Kadesh Barnea was the closest place where men could approach in the region of the spaceport without special permission. Shulgi had gone there to pray and make offerings to the god who judges, and nearly 1,000 years before him, the Sumerian king Gilgamesh stopped there to obtain the special permission. It was the place the Sumerians called Badgal-Din-Gur, and Sargon of Akkad, Dur-Mal-Ilani. clearly listing it in his inscriptions as a place in Tilmun, the Sinai Peninsula. It was the place, we suggest, which the Bible called Kadesh Barnea, and where Abraham stood with his elite troops, blocking the invaders' advance, to the spaceport proper. The hints in the Old Testament become a detailed tale in the Kedorlaomer texts, which make clear that the war was intended to prevent the return of Marduk and thwart the efforts of Nabu to gain access to the spaceport. These texts not only name the very same kings who are mentioned in the Bible, but even repeat the biblical detail of the switch of allegiance in the 13th year. As we return to the Kedorlaomer texts to obtain the details for the biblical frame, we should bear in mind that they were written by a Babylonian historian who favored Marduk's desire to make Babylon the heavenward navel in the four regions. It was to thwart this that the gods opposing Marduk ordered Kedorlaomer to seize and defile Babylon. The gods, to Kedorlaomer, king of the land Elam, they decreed, descend there. That which to the city was bad he performed. In Babylon, the precious city of Marduk, sovereignty he seized. In Babylon, the city of the king of the gods, Marduk, kingship he overthrew. To herds of gods, its temple he made a den. Flying ravens, loud shrieking, their dung dropped there. The despoiling of Babylon was only the beginning. After the bad deeds were done there, Utu Shamash sought action against Nabu, who, he said in accusation, had subverted the allegiance of a certain king to his father, Ninhar-Sin. It happened, the Kedorlaomer text states, in the 13th year, just as Genesis chapter 14 states, before the gods, the son of his father, came. On that day Shamash, the bright one, against the Lord of Lords Marduk, he said, the faithfulness of his heart, the king, betrayed. In the time of the 13th year, a falling out against my father he had, to his faith-keeping the king ceased to attend. All this Nabu has caused to happen. The assembled gods, thus alerted to the role of Nabu in the spreading rebellions, put together a coalition of loyal kings and appointed the Elamite Kedorlaomer as its military commander. Their first order was that Borsippa, the stronghold of Nabu with weapons, be despoiled. Carrying out the order, Kedorlaomer, with wicked thoughts against Marduk, the shrine of Borsippa with fire he destroyed, and its sons with a sword he slew. Then the military expedition against the rebellious kings was ordered. The Babylonian text lists the targets to be attacked and the names of their attackers. We easily recognize the biblical names among them. Eriaku, Arioch, was to attack Shebu, Beersheba. And Tudgula, Tidal, was to smite with a sword the sons of Gaza. Acting in accordance with an oracle of Ishtar, the army put together by the kings of the east arrived in Transjordan. First to be attacked was a stronghold in the high land, then Rabbatum. The route was the same as the one described in the Bible, from the highland in the north to the district of Rabat Ammon in the center, southward around the Dead Sea. Thereafter, Dermah-Ilani was to be captured, and the Canaanite cities, including Gaza and Beersheba in the Negev, were to be punished. But at Dermah-Ilani, according to the Babylonian text, the son of the priest, whom the gods in their true counsel had anointed, stood in the invader's way, and the despoiling prevented. Could the Babylonian text indeed refer to Abraham, the son of Terah, the priest, and spell out his role in turning back the invaders? The possibility is strengthened by the fact that the Mesopotamian and biblical texts relate the same event in the same locality with the same outcome. But there is more to it than just a possibility, for we have come upon one highly intriguing clue. This is the unnoticed fact that the date formulas for the reign of Amar-Sin call his seventh year, the crucial year, 2041 BC, the year of the military expedition, also Muni-Ibru-Umbahul. which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 100, Year in which the Shepherding Abode of Ibru'um was attacked. Can this reference and the exact crucial year be other than to Abraham and his shepherding abode? There is also a possible pictorial commemoration of the invasion. This is a scene carved on a Sumerian cylinder seal, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 101. It has been regarded as depicting the journey of Etana, an earlier king of Kish, to the winged gateway, where an eagle took him aloft so high that the earth disappeared from view. But the seal depicts the crowned hero on horseback, too early for Etana's time, and standing between the site of the winged gateway and two distinct groups, one of four armed mighty men, whose leader is also on horseback, moves toward a cultivated area in the Sinai Peninsula, indicated by the symbol of Sin's crescent with wheat growing in it. The other is of five kings, facing in the opposite direction. The depiction thus has all the elements of an ancient illustration of the War of the Kings, and the role of the priest's son in it, rather than that of Etana's journey to the spaceport. The hero, depicted in the center atop an animal, could thus be Abraham rather than Etana. Having carried out his mission to protect the spaceport, Abraham returned to his base near Hebron. Encouraged by his feat, the Canaanite kings marched their forces to intercept the retreating army from the east. But the invaders beat them and seized all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah, as well as one prize hostage. They took with them Lot, the nephew of Abraham, who was residing at Sodom. On hearing the news, Abraham called up his best cavalrymen and pursued the retreating invaders. Catching up with them near Damascus, he succeeded in releasing Lot and retrieving all the booty. Upon his return, he was greeted as a victor in the valley of Shalem, Jerusalem. And Melchizedek, the king of Shalem, brought forth bread and wine. For he was a priest unto the God Most High, and he blessed him, saying, Blessed be Abram unto the God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be the God Most High, who hath delivered thine foes into thine hand. Soon the Canaanite kings also arrived to thank Abraham, and offered him all the seized possessions as a reward. But Abraham, saying that his local allies could share in that, refused to take even a shoelace for himself or his warriors. He had acted neither out of friendship for the Canaanite kings, nor out of enmity for the Eastern Alliance. In the war between the house of Nanar and the house of Marduk, he was neutral. It was for Yahweh, the God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I have raised my hands, he stated. The failed invasion did not arrest the rush of momentous events in the ancient world. A year later, in 2040 BC, Mentuhotep II, leader of the Theban princes, defeated the northern pharaohs and extended the rule of Thebes and of its god up to the western approaches to the Sinai Peninsula. In the following year, Amar Sin attempted to reach the Sinai Peninsula by sea, only to find his death by a poisonous bite. The attacks on the spaceport were thwarted, but the danger to it was not removed, and the efforts of Marduk to gain the supremacy intensified evermore. 15 years later, Sodom and Gomorrah went up in flames when Ninurta and Nergal unleashed the doomsday weapons. Chapter 14. The Nuclear Holocaust. Doomsday came in the 24th year when Abraham, encamped near Hebron, was 99 years old. And the Lord appeared unto him in the terebrinth grove of Mamre, as he was sitting at the entrance of the tent, in the heat of the day. And he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were stationed upon him. And as he saw them, he ran from the entrance of the tent towards them and bowed to the ground. Swiftly, from a typical Middle Eastern scene of a potentate resting in the shade of his tent, the biblical narrator of Genesis chapter 18 raised Abraham's eyes and thrust him into a sudden encounter with divine beings. Though Abraham was gazing out, he did not see the three approaching. They were suddenly stationed upon him. And though they were men, he at once recognized their true identity and bowed to them, calling them my lords, and asking them not to pass over above thy servant until he had a chance to prepare for them a sumptuous meal. It was dusk when the divine visitors finished eating and resting. Asking about Sarah, their leader said to Abraham, "Return I shall unto thee at this time next year. By then Sarah thy wife will have a son." The promise of a rightful heir to Abraham and Sarah at their old age was not the sole reason for dropping down on Abraham. There was a more ominous purpose. And the men rose up from there to survey over upon Sodom. And Abraham had gone with them to see them off. And the Lord said, "Can I conceal from Abraham that which I am about to do?" Recalling Abraham's past services and promised future, the Lord then disclosed to him the true purpose of the divine journey: to verify accusations against Sodom and Gomorrah. The outcry regarding Sodom and Gomorrah being great and the accusation against them being grievous, the Lord said he had decided to come down and verify. If it is, as the outcry reaching me, they will destroy completely, and if not, I wish to know. The ensuing destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah has become one of the most frequently depicted and preached about biblical episodes. The Orthodox and the fundamentalists never doubted that the Lord God had literally poured fire and brimstone from the skies to wipe the sinful cities off the face of the earth. The scholarly and sophisticated have as tenaciously sought to find natural explanations for the biblical story: an earthquake, a volcanic eruption, some other natural phenomenon which, they grant, might have been interpreted as an act of God, a punishment befitting the sin. But so far as the biblical narrative is concerned, and until now it has been the only source for all the interpretations, the event was most definitely not a natural calamity. It is described as a premeditated event. The Lord discloses to Abraham ahead of time what is about to happen and why. It is an avoidable event, not a calamity caused by irreversible natural forces. The calamity shall come to pass only if the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah will be confirmed. And thirdly, as we shall soon discover, it was also a postponable event, one whose occurrence could be made to happen earlier or later, at will. Realizing the avoidability of the calamity, Abraham embarked upon a tactic of argumentative attrition. "Perhaps there be 50 righteous ones inside the city," he said. "Wilt thou destroy and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous ones within it?" Then he quickly added, "Far be it from you to do such a thing, to slay the righteous with the guilty. Far be it from you, the judge of all the earth, not to do justice. A mortal preaching to his deity. And the plea is for calling off the destruction, the premeditated and avoidable destruction, if there be 50 righteous ones in the city." But no sooner had the Lord agreed to spare the city, if there be found such 50 persons, than Abraham, who might have chosen the number 50 knowing that it would strike a special chord, wondered out loud if the Lord shall destroy if the number were 5 short. When the Lord agreed to call off the destruction, if only 45 be found righteous, Abraham continued to bargain the number down to 40, then 30, then 20, then 10. And the Lord said, "I shall not destroy if there be 10. And he departed as he finished speaking to Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. At eve time, the two companions of the Lord, the biblical narrative now refers to them as Malachim, translated angels, but meaning emissaries, arrived at Sodom, their task being to verify the accusations against the city and report their findings back to the Lord. Lot, who was sitting at the city's gate, recognized at once, as Abraham had done earlier, the divine nature of the two visitors, their identity evidently being given away by their attire or weapons, or perhaps by the manner, flying over, in which they arrived. Now it was Lot's turn to insist on hospitality, and the two accepted his invitation to spend the night at his home. But it was not to be a restful night, for the news of their arrival had stirred up the whole city. They had hardly lain down when the people of the city, the people of Sodom, surrounded the house, young and old, the whole population from every quarter, and they called unto Lot and said unto him, Where are the men who came unto you tonight? Bring them to us, that we may know them. When Lot failed to do so, the crowd surged to break their way in, but the two Malachim smote the people who were at the house's entrance with blindness, both young and old, and they wearied themselves trying to find the doorway. Realizing that of all the townspeople only Lot was righteous, the two emissaries needed no further investigation. The fate of the city was sealed. And they said unto Lot, Who else hast thou here besides thee? A son-in-law, thy sons and daughters, any other relative? All who are in this city, bring them out from this place, for we are about to destroy it. Rushing to convey the news to his sons-in-law, Lot only met disbelief and laughter. So at dawn the emissaries urged Lot to escape without delay, taking with him only his wife and their two unmarried daughters who lived with him at home. But Lot tarried, so the men took hold of his hand, and his wife's hand, and his two daughters' hands, for Yahweh's mercy was upon him, and they brought them out, and put them down outside the city. Having literally carried the foursome aloft, then put them down outside the city, the emissaries urged Lot to flee to the mountains. Escape for thy life. Look not behind thee, neither stop thou anywhere in the plain. They instructed him, unto the mountains escape, lest thou perish. But Lot, afraid that they would not reach the mountains in time, and would be overtaken by the evil and die, had a suggestion. Could the upheavaling of Sodom be delayed until he had reached the town of Zoar, the farthest one away from Sodom? Agreeing, one of the emissaries asked him to hurry there. Haste thee to escape thither, for I will be unable to do anything until thou hast arrived there. The calamity was thus not only predictable and avoidable, but also postponable. And it could be made to afflict various cities at different times. No natural catastrophe could have featured all these aspects. The sun was risen over the earth when Lot arrived at Zoar, and the Lord rained upon Sodom and Gomorrah, from the skies, brimstone and fire that had come from Yahweh. And he upheavaled those cities, and the whole plain, and all the inhabitants of the cities, and all the vegetation that grows from the ground. The cities, the people, the vegetation, everything was upheavaled by the God's weapon. Its heat and fire scorched all before it. Its radiation affected people even at some distance away. Lot's wife, ignoring the admonition not to stop to look back as they were fleeing away from Sodom, turned to a pillar of vapor. The evil Lot had feared had caught up with her. One by one the cities, which had outraged the Lord, were upheavaled, and each time Lot was allowed to escape. For when the gods devastated the cities of the plain, the gods remembered Abraham and sent Lot away out of the upheavaling of the cities. And Lot, as instructed, went on to dwell in the mountain, and dwelt in a cave, he and his two daughters with him. Having witnessed the fiery destruction of all life in the Jordan plain, and the unseen hand of death which vaporized their mother, what were Lot and his daughters to think? They thought, we learn from the biblical narrative, that they had witnessed the end of mankind upon the earth, that the three of them were the sole survivors of the human race, and therefore the only way to preserve mankind was to commit incest and have the daughters conceive children by their own father. And the elder said unto the younger, Our father is old, and there is not a man on earth to squire us in the manner of all on earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, then lie down with him, so that we shall preserve the seed of life from our father. And having done so, both became pregnant and bore children. The night before the Holocaust must have been a night of anxiety and sleeplessness for Abraham, of wondering whether enough righteous ones were found in Sodom to have the city spared, of concern about the fate of Lot and his family. And Abraham got up early in the morning to the place where he had stood facing Yahweh, and he looked in the direction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and the region of the plain, and he beheld their smoke rising from the earth as the smoke of a furnace. He was witnessing a Hiroshima and a Nagasaki, the destruction of a fertile and populated plain by atomic weapons. The year was 2024 BC. Where are the remains of Sodom and Gomorrah today? Ancient Greek and Roman geographers reported that the once fertile valley of the five cities was inundated following the catastrophe. Modern scholars believe that the upheavaling described in the Bible caused a breach in the southern shore of the Dead Sea, letting its waters pour through to submerge the low-lying region to the south. The remaining portion of what was once the southern shore became the feature figuratively called by the natives El Lisan, the tongue. And the once populated valley with its five cities became a new southern part of the Dead Sea, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 102, still bearing the local nickname Lot's Sea. In the north, the outpouring of the waters southward caused the shoreline to recede. The ancient reports have been confirmed in modern times by various researchers, beginning with an exhaustive exploration of the area in the 1920s by a scientific mission sponsored by the Vatican's Pontifical Biblical Institute. Leading archaeologists such as W. F. Albright and P. Harland discovered that settlements in the mountains around the region were abruptly abandoned in the 21st century B.C., and were not reoccupied for several centuries thereafter. And to this very day, the water of springs surrounding the Dead Sea has been found to be contaminated with radioactivity, enough to induce sterility, and allied afflictions in any animals and humans that absorbed it over a number of years. The cloud of death, rising in the skies from the cities of the plain, frightened not only Lot and his daughters, but also Abraham. And he did not feel safe even in the Hebron Mountains, some 50 miles away. We are told by the Bible that he pulled up his encampment and moved farther away, westward, to reside at Gerar. Also, at no time thereafter did he venture into the Sinai. Even years later, when Abraham's son Isaac wanted to go to Egypt on account of a famine in Canaan, Yahweh appeared unto him and said, "Go not down to Egypt. Dwell in the land which I will show thee." The passage through the Sinai Peninsula was apparently still unsafe. But why? The destruction of the cities of the plain, we believe, was only a sideshow. Concurrently, the spaceport in the Sinai Peninsula was also obliterated with nuclear weapons, leaving behind a deadly radiation that lingered on for many years thereafter. The main nuclear target was in the Sinai Peninsula, and the real victim in the end was Sumer itself. Though the end of Ur came swiftly, its sad fate loomed darker ever since the War of the Kings, coming nearer and nearer, like the sound of a distant drummer, an execution's drummer, getting closer, growing louder with each passing year. The year of doom, 2024 BC, was the sixth year of the reign of Ibbi-Sin, the last king of Ur. But to find the reasons for the calamity, explanations of its nature, and details of its scope, we will have to study the records of those fateful years back from the time of that war. Having failed in their mission, and twice humiliated by the hand of Abraham, once at Kadesh Barnea, then again near Damascus, the invading kings were promptly removed from their thrones. In Ur, Amar-Sin was replaced by his brother, Shu-Sin, who ascended the throne to find the Grand Alliance shattered, and Ur's erstwhile allies now nibbling at her crumbling empire. Although they too had been discredited by the War of the Kings, Nannar and Inanna were at first the gods in whom Shu Sin had put his trust. It was Nannar, Shu Sin's early inscription stated, who had called his name to kingship. He was beloved of Inanna, and she herself presented him to Nannar, which can be seen in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 103. The holy Inanna, Shu Sin boasted, the one endowed with astounding qualities, the first daughter of Sin, grant him weapons with which to engage in battle the enemy country, which is disobedient. But all this was insufficient to hold together the Sumerian Empire, and Shu Sin soon turned to greater gods for succor. Judging from the date formulas, annual inscriptions for royal as well as commercial and social purposes, in which each successive year of a king's reign was designated by the major event of that year, Shu Sin, in the second year of his reign, sought the favors of Enki by constructing for that god a special boat that could navigate the high seas all the way to the lower world. The third year of reign was also one of preoccupation with the pro-Enki alignment. Little else is known of this effort, which could have been a roundabout way of pacifying the followers of Marduk and Nabu. But the effort evidently failed, for the fourth and fifth years witnessed the building of a massive wall on the western frontier of Mesopotamia, specifically aimed at warding off incursions by the Westerners, followers of Marduk. As the pressures from the west kept rising, Shu Sin turned to the great gods of Nippur for forgiveness and salvation. The date formulas confirmed by the archaeological excavations of the American expedition to Nippur reveal that Shu Sin undertook massive reconstruction works at Nippur's sacred precinct, on a scale unknown since the days of Ur-Nammu. The works culminated with the raising of a stela honoring Enlil and Ninlil, a stela as no king had built before. Desperately, Shu Sin sought acceptance, confirmation that he was the king whom Enlil, in his heart, had chosen. But Enlil was not there to answer. Only Ninlil, Enlil's spouse, who remained in Nippur, heard Shu Sin's supplications. Responding with compassion, so as to prolong the well-being of Shu Sin, to extend the time of his crown, she gave him a weapon, which, with radiance, strikes down, whose awesome flash reaches the sky. A Shu Sin text, catalogued as Collection B, suggests that in his efforts to re-establish the olden links with Nippur, Shu Sin may have attempted a reconciliation with the Nippurites, such as the family of Tira, who had left Ur after the death of Ur-Nammu. The text states that after he made the region where Haran was situated tremble in awe of his weapons, a peace gesture was made. Shu Sin sent there his own daughter as a bride, presumably to the region's chief or his son. She then returned to Sumer with an entourage of that region's citizens, establishing a town for Enlil and Ninlil on the boundary of Nippur. It was the first time since the days when fates were decreed that a king had established a town for Enlil and Ninlil, Shu Sin stated in obvious expectation of praise. With the probable assistance of the repatriated Nippurites, Shu Sin also reinstated the high temple services at Nippur, bestowing upon himself the role and title of high priest. Yet all this was to no avail. Instead of greater security, there were greater dangers, and concern about the loyalty of distant provinces gave way to worry about Sumer's own territory. The mighty king, the king of Ur, Shu Sin's inscription said, found that the shepherding of the land, of Sumer itself, had become the principal royal burden. There was one final effort to entice Enlil back to Sumer, to find shelter under his aegis. On the apparent advice of Ninlil, Shu Sin built for the divine couple a great touring boat, fit for the largest rivers. He decorated it perfectly with precious stones, outfitted it with oars made of the finest wood, punting poles, and an artful rudder, and furnished it with all manner of comfort, including a bridal bed. He then placed the touring boat in the wide basin facing Ninlil's house of pleasure. The nostalgic aspects struck a chord in Ninlil's heart, for he had fallen in love with Ninlil when she was still a young nurse, when he saw her bathing naked in the river, and he did come back to Nippur. When Ninlil heard all this, from horizon to horizon he hurried, from south to north he traveled, through the skies, over earth he hurried, to greatly rejoice with his beloved queen, Ninlil. The sentimental journey, however, was only a brief interlude. Some crucial lines before the end of the tablet are missing, so we are deprived of the details of what happened then. But the very last lines refer to Ninurta, the great warrior of Enlil, who befuddled the intruder, apparently after an inscription, an evil inscription, was discovered on an effigy in the boat, intended perhaps to place a curse on Enlil and Ninlil. There is no record available of Enlil's reaction to the foul play, but all other evidence suggests that he again left Nippur, this time apparently taking Ninlil with him. Soon thereafter, February 2031 BC by our calendar, the Near East was awed by a total lunar eclipse, which blacked out the moon during the night for its full course from horizon to horizon. The oracle priests of Nippur could not allay Shu Sin's anxiety. It was, they said in their written message, an omen to the king who rules the four regions. His wall will be destroyed. Ur will become desolate. Rejected by the great olden gods, Shu Sin engaged in one final act, either out of defiance or as a last straw to gain divine support. He went ahead and built, in the very sacred precinct of Nippur, a shrine to a young god named Shara. He was a son of Inanna, and like Lugalbanda, who bore this epithet in earlier days, so was this new Shara, prince, a son of a king. In the inscription dedicating to the temple, Shu Sin claimed that he was the young god's father. To divine Shara, heavenly hero, the beloved son of Inanna. His father, Shu Sin, the powerful king, king of Ur, king of the four regions, has built for him the temple Shagipada, his beloved shrine. May the king have life. It was the ninth year of Shu Sin's reign. It was also his last. The new ruler of the throne of Ur, Ibi Sin, could not stop the retreat and retrenchment. All he could do was rush the construction of walls and fortifications in the heart of Sumer, around Ur and Nippur. The rest of the country was left unprotected. His own date formulas, of which none have been found beyond this fifth year, although he reigned longer, tell little of the circumstances of his days. Much more is learned from the cessation of other customary messages and trade documents. Thus, the messages of loyalty, which the other subordinate urban centers were expected to send to Ur each year, ceased to arrive from one center after the other. First to cease were the loyalty messages from the western districts. Then in the third year, the capitals of eastern provinces stopped their dispatch. In that third year, Ur's foreign commerce stopped with a significant suddenness. At the tax collection crossroads of Drahem, near Nippur, where shipments of goods and cattle and the collection of taxes thereon were recorded throughout the third dynasty of Ur, records of which thousands of intact clay tablets were found, the meticulous account-keeping also stopped abruptly in that third year. Ignoring Nippur, whose great gods had left her, Ibi Sin put his trust again in Ninar and Inanna, installing himself in his second year as high priest of Inanna's temple in Uruk. Repeatedly he asked for guidance and reassurance from his gods, but all he was hearing were oracles of destruction and doom. In the fourth year of his reign, he was told that the sun in the west will arise. It is an omen for Ibi Sin. Ur shall be judged. In the fifth year, Ibi Sin sought further strength by becoming high priest of Inanna at her shrine at Ur. But that, too, was of no help. That year, the other cities of Sumer itself ceased sending the messages of allegiance. It was also the last year in which those cities delivered the traditional sacrificial animals for Nannar's temple in Ur. The central authority of Ur, her gods,